Good evening, good morning, wherever you may be in this great, big, beautiful world of ours. Thank you for tuning in to the best in overnight talk radio. This is Coast to Coast AM, sitting in for George Norrie. I'm Dave Schrader. Tonight I'll be joined in the first 2 hours by author and journalist Sarah Whalen. She'll discuss her research into the life of Princess Diana. Her book, which is out and available, Royal Vengeance, The Assassination of Princess Diana, and the Ancient Royal Cult of Human Sacrifice. What is this? We're going to get into it. That's what's coming up in the first half of the show. Plus, we'll open up phone lines next hour if you have questions for our guest. A little later on in the show, we'll be talking to Dahlia Schweitzer, who will discuss her new book, Going Viral, Zombies, Viruses, and the End of the World, which explores stories of pandemics and disease outbreaks in American fictional media. Why is it always such a fascination to us? Why are we so interested in the idea of viral outbreak? And why does the media push that on us? The swine flu, the bird flu, Ebola, it always seems that there's some new disease about to ravage and destroy our planet that never comes to fruition. Are these just games that are being played with us? We'll talk about that and more. We've got a lot of strange stuff on tap tonight. I want to hear from you as well as the show progresses. If you have questions or points, you can simply email them to me at dave@darknessradio.com. dave@darknessradio.com. And I'll try to weave them in throughout the entirety of this evening's show. Or you can wait for the open phone lines, which we will do during each guest's segment. Stay tuned. A lot of fun stuff coming. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Whenever we lose somebody that's part of the public eye, it's met with many different thoughts and ways to process. I mean, look at the popularity of the belief that Elvis Presley may have faked his own death. Michael Jackson may have faked his own death. Is this a way to just escape the public eye, the scrutiny, the loss of innocence, the loss of privacy? Do these celebrities choose these points? People are fascinated by that. And those that aren't even dead, like Paul McCartney, who people are talking about having been killed in a car accident and being replaced by a doppelganger. And that's not just something from the weird 60s. That's followed straight through to today, current day. Singer Avril Lavigne has a very similar conspiracy circulating about her, that she died and was replaced by her body double. When we talk about stories like this, it's easy to roll your eyes and throw your head back, sigh in disbelief or sometimes in disgust. But there are some celebrities, there are some personalities that seem to transcend and capture the attention of the world. And when their deaths come, maybe we don't want to accept that their death was nothing more than an accident. It had to be something more nefarious. Well, what happens when you start to investigate a claim like that and you start finding things that substantiate your thoughts and your concerns? Well, that's what our guest is here for this evening. Sarah Whalen, our guest for the first 2 hours. Her book is called Royal Vengeance, The Assassination of Princess Diana and the Ancient Royal Cult of Human Sacrifice. She is a professional writer specializing in short essays. Royal Vengeance is her first book, but she's edited and contributed to books in the past, and the books have been in political history and international law. She has a BA in anthropology, archaeology, and history from the University of Miami, Florida, with honors, an MA in history from NYU, a JD law degree from New York Law School, and an L1M degree in law from Temple University, Beasley School of Law in Philadelphia, where she was a fully funded by the Honorable Abraham Friedman Teaching Fellow. She's here with us this evening to give us a unique insight and perspective to a story that has captured the attention of the world with the untimely death of Princess Diana. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dave. It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
We all remember the tragedy and the information that night. I was at a Famous Dave's with my mom and dad and having dinner when the news broke of the accident. And that at that point, there was just the fact that she had been injured in the accident. that
Right. In the beginning, they thought she, in fact, she did survive. She survived the initial crash. She died because they delayed almost 2 hours to bring her to the hospital, and she slowly bled to death from a pulmonary tear in the ambulance.
Well, let's start to talk about this. I mean, that night, like I said, I remember where I was. And you know what? The Royals were not even a big part of my life, although I do remember watching the wedding of Princess Di and Charles, you know, with my one of my best friends and his mom. We stayed up late to watch that, or I should say got up early to watch it.
Right.
And witnessed it. And then I was there for her death, and I remember those moments. Why are Americans, or the world for that matter, so fascinated by the story of the Royals?
Well, I think in our lifetime, at least, you know, these are living people. It's not like reading about historical figures. These are people we see on television. We read about them in all the popular newspapers. You know, they're in People magazine. You don't have to pull out a big, dusty book of history to take a look at their lives. And so, and also because we have access to a lot more information than I think humanity has ever had. So people have a lot of information to choose from. And of course, I mean, Princess Diana was not just beautiful, but she, and I don't think not just a celebrity either. I think she was a truly unique person, and almost a divine person. She had a divine persona, and this is ancient. This goes back to the Great Mother, the goddess myth, and this is something that just resonates, I think, in the human psyche, and you know it when you see it. It's an intuitive kind of experience, and people had this on a very great scale with Princess Diana, and I think it was something perhaps she herself was not fully aware of. It really wasn't just the hats or the stylish clothes or, you know, the glamorous lifestyle. I think people resonated with Princess Diana on a much deeper vibration, even more than the queen. And of course, you know, kings and queens, they're supposed to personify God or gods on earth. And people historically have always related to them that way. I mean, that is really the appeal of royalty. And so, you know, she hooked in to a really ancient primeval kind of force. And it's never been broken, even with her death.
When you first heard about the accident and about the death, did the idea of conspiracy come to mind at all? Was that even a part of your world?
Oh, well, I have to say it did immediately. You know, my background is in both international and criminal law. I worked in both fields, sometimes together. And I think, you know, naturally, I mean, I'm kind of interested in conspiracies by nature. And that's probably one reason I went into those fields. So I thought she would be killed long before she actually did die. I thought, especially after her Panorama interview on the BBC, which was in around Thanksgiving of 1995, she gave a interview that was devastating to the monarchy. It was even more harmful than the book she had co-authored with Andrew Morton, Diana, Her True Story. And I don't think the royals were fooled at all by her claims of, you know, not having collaborated. I think they knew with great certainty that she had, in fact, written the book herself. And it had been polished by Andrew Morton. But, you know, they were prepared to write out the book because so much had already been done. But the BBC Panorama interview, where she said that Charles was unfit to reign. She wanted to have a regency where she was appointed regent to be tutor for her son, Prince William, and that Charles could, you know, go off to Italy and with his mistress and never take the throne. And she also made some remarks about the queen that were quite cutting. They were carefully delivered, but this is not the way. If she had lived 500 years earlier, Diana could have been, frankly, executed for even just imagining the death of the monarch, let alone the unfitness of the monarch. I mean, royalty has really sewn up its position. You can't criticize it. The people of Britain, historically, they don't live lives like we do in America. Their speech is very constrained. The queen is on the money. You know, dead people are on our money, but a living queen is on their money. And if there's a king before her, he was on the money. So these are powerful people, and they permeate institutions. Parliament is indeed, you know, an institution of the people, but it's a relatively modern one. Before that, royals had a tight grip on just about everything, life and death, that happened around them. And the British royals are the one royal family that has genuinely survived the upheavals of two world wars and, you know, communist revolutions that, you know, overthrew large groups of them. But in the meantime, they've consolidated a great deal of power. And when Diana gave her interview on BBC Panorama and said that Charles was unfit to rule, I told my brother and my husband, I said, I give her 6 months. She's not going to live the year. And in fact, it was a year and a half before she had her car crash. And after the car crash happened, my brother called me and he said, you know, I always make fun of you for your conspiracy theories, but I have to admit that I think you're right. Not that my brother is, you know, the authority on it, but I felt at that time the royal family really had no choice but to do it in terms of what they saw as their survival.
Well, prior to the accident, prior to her death being taken, you cite the interview that she did, which certainly is damning, but, you know, there's been controversy surrounding the royals going all the way back through all of time and history. Do we just believe that anytime somebody spoke up against them that they would be put to death?
Well, sometimes people were. Certainly in modern times, you can't do that. I mean, the power of the king to execute, or the monarch to execute, you know, someone they don't like, or a rival, or someone they feel is threatening to them. I mean, this power is much diminished. It's not even spoken about anymore. But does it happen? Yes, I think it does. And I think they're quite artful in what they do. And they've had, you know, many thousands of years of practice. Because such executions, you know, something very interesting happened during the reign of Henry VIII, who, of course, lived a long time, and he reigned a long time. And he executed many, many people other than, you know, two wives whom he disliked and decided to, you know, get rid of. But if you look at it in terms of Henry VIII's problems with fertility, and if you look at kingship as basically a fertility cult, I mean, the king exists. The king takes on a divine role. But part of that role comes with the responsibility of making sure that everything runs well, that the land is fertile, that crops are full, that people have children who are healthy, and animals give birth to other animals. You know, on and on, it's a cycle. And whenever this cycle is broken by bad weather or a virus or, you know, just something that's completely unforeseen, the custom would be that the king would sacrifice himself. And it was really specific about how this would be done. Usually, they'd get their head cut off and blood would fall on the earth and people would, you know, go and try to pick up a little bit of that blood in a handkerchief or a rag. And, you know, that was considered a divine relic. And any little piece of their clothing that had blood on it was also considered to be a great treasure, because blood was believed to be life, source of life, fertility. These customs in England have not disappeared. And they're also very widespread. You see them all around the world. But Henry VIII made a big innovation in his kingship. It had started before him, but he perfected it to an art. Instead of sacrificing himself when things went bad, he would sacrifice someone else. So the idea was that you could find a substitute to be sacrificed so that things could get back on kilter and the land would again be fertile and everyone would be happy. But that sacrifice had to, it had to be a royal personage, either by marriage or by blood. And someone like Anne Boleyn, who was Henry's second wife, mother of the first Queen Elizabeth, you know, she had several miscarriages, stillbirths, she had fertility problems, and she could not give Henry the male heir. So when she had her, she miscarried a son, he immediately started figuring out how to sacrifice her, because clearly something was wrong, people were uneasy, and he cut her head off. The blood fell on the land, the whole incident was walked through in a very ancient manner. If you notice, all the people in Henry VIII's reign, they don't protest their innocence, even though their innocence can be easily proved. Instead, they make allusions. Anne Boleyn herself was accused of being a witch. And part of those accusations stem from the fact that she herself made remarks that she was a witch, that she came from this background of people who understood the old ways, the pre-Christian ways of England, were willing to sacrifice themselves by having their heads cut off and their blood spread upon the ground. She's related to the Howards and one of Henry's later wives, who he also executes by decapitation, Catherine Howard. She and Anne Boleyn were cousins. Coming from this same tradition that came from a family line who were familiar with the ancient sacrifices.
So are you saying that in a sense they looked at it as an honor to be part of the sacrifice because they knew that it was for the greater good of the world, for the country, whatever?
Absolutely.
Really?
They didn't want it, but they knew that this was the process. And even if you look at the letters of the diplomats at the court, especially from the Roman Catholic countries, they make reference to this as being, an English non-Christian custom. Even the Howards are described as, you know, a line of people who their manner, their psychology, if you will, is to be sacrificed by English kings. It's in a lot of the letters that they exchange. There are allusions to it. Other people who were executed by Henry VIII also made allusions that they knew what was going on. They knew why they were being executed. And they imply that it's not for the reasons that are given. So it's actually pretty common in Henry VIII executed.
All right. And not that I'm saying it's okay, but I mean, you kind of understand that back then they had a lot of screwy beliefs, and the idea of sacrifices and buying into different aspects of the Bible that called for that. All right, you know, that was the Dark Ages. These people believed in that type of thing. We're in a more enlightened environment at this point. At least
right.
I'd like to think so. I think that's where a lot of people run into the problem of believing in a conspiracy, especially one that runs this deep and that deals with murder for, you know, or sacrifice for posterity. There are other ways to have dealt with Diana, in comparison, and when I said earlier, do we really want to believe that if you just spoke poorly against the royal family, you'd be put to death? I know that there's a long history of that. But again, that was during the dark ages and the dark times. This isn't something that we think of in the 1900s and 2000s as a reality. When we come back, we'll continue talking about this. We'll take your calls a little bit next hour. Stay tuned. We've got a lot more coming your way. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, and this is Coast to Coast AM. We're back with Sarah Whalen. She's the author of Royal Vengeance, The Assassination of Princess Diana, and The Ancient Royal Cult of Human Sacrifice. Sarah, here's something that, you know, I know a lot of the skeptics and the idea of this being a conspiracy bandy about, and it does make sense. You know, I understand that Diana could be considered a rogue agent and was an embarrassment in the eyes of the royals, that she was causing a lot of dismay. But she was also not shy about talking about her depression and other mental issues. Wouldn't it have just been a lot easier to discredit her and say that these were psychotic breaks, mental breakdowns, and have her institutionalized or that was summarily dismissed?
That was always her fear, that she would be institutionalized. In fact, she wrote about it. She said she thought they were planning a car accident where she would either suffer death or a head injury, and she would end up in an institution. She considered that, and in fact, there was discussion early on about, I don't know if institutionalizing is the right word, but putting her in a mental hospital, because immediately after the marriage, after the wedding, you know, Charles and Diana were just mismatched personalities, and if they were old school royals, they would have worked something out. They would have worked out an accommodation. But Diana, of course, had, you know, this very traumatic childhood with her parents being divorced and her mother, you know, supposedly abandoning her from a child's point of view. And, you know, they both had a lot of issues to work out. Charles always felt mistreated by his parents. So, you know, these psychological issues made the marriage very unworkable. That being said, there were several books, one by Penny Junor, who is a very pro-royal family writer. And in it, you know, she basically said that, you know, Princess Diana had, I think, borderline personality disorder. And several writers, Sally Bedell Smith, alluded to it. Lady Colin Campbell, who wrote several biographies of Princess Diana, and some research directly with Diana herself, Lady Colin Campbell concluded that Princess Diana had, you know, mental illness. And so that theory was certainly out there. And at times, you
well,
know,
is it really a theory? I mean, she had come forward herself saying that she had depression, anxieties, and some other issues that might make her, and especially if she's on any kind of medication, could make her paranoid, delusional, schizophrenic.
Well, I don't think she called herself that. She did admit to depression.
No, I said depression and anxiety. I just said, but if you're on medication, sometimes that can give you paranoid delusions and hallucinations. I'm just saying that's sometimes a side effect of the different medications that they can put you on.
Right, but I think also, you know, she had good reason to be paranoid. I mean, I think she did have, you know, some, I'm sure she had depression, she had anxiety. You know, there was some evidence of, you know, what a psychiatrist might say is pathology, the cutting of herself. You know, she claims she cut herself with a penknife and a lemon slicer, but she did draw blood. She scarred herself. And, you know, usually that's a pretty strong indicator of a deep psychosis when someone is harming themselves that way. It's something that a regular psychiatrist would take immediate notice of. And I think the royal family, you know, that was certainly an option. But at the same time, she was so popular. She had two children. So you have to make a decision. Do you want them to continue with their mother, who may be, you know, psychologically harming them? You know, the British solved this by sending their children off to boarding school at fairly young ages, much younger than we would do it in the U.S. And in fact, this was done for William and Harry. They were, you know, roped out of Dodge. And, you know, they came back to see her on holidays. But for the most part, her children were off at boarding school. And, you know, that was where they spent most of their time. But I think that she did have good cause to be concerned for her safety. And she had a lover. She took a lover much earlier than has ever been admitted. I mean, you know, usually Barry Manicky, they say he came to work for her in 1985. He was her bodyguard. But Barry Manicky was a personal protection officer for the Royals long before that. He was a career police officer. And I've seen photos of Barry Manicky with Princess Diana from 1981, 1982. So that was before Prince Harry was born. And then you have the issue of Prince Harry's paternity, which kind of puts a wrinkle in things. And then, you know, apparently at some point Barry Manicky, there was a belief he might sell his story, and he was killed in a car crash. I mean, he was on a motorcycle riding on the back of another police officer's motorcycle, and you know, he wasn't even hit. The impact of the bike sliding when a 17-year-old girl pulled out into the roadway in her Fiesta car, she didn't even hit them. But when the bike slid, the driver of the bike slid the bike, Barry Manicky went flying off the back, hit the Fiesta's back window, and it broke Manicky's spine in two places. Now, it's really what's unusual about this incident is there were some witnesses to the accident. The driver, the teenage driver, Nicola Chopp, she said that the driver was a woman with glasses who fled the scene. There was a eyewitness named Richard, I think, Purcell, a passerby, who assisted her with getting out of the car, and he was never called as a witness. He saw everything. He was never called as a witness. There was an inquest into Barry Manicky's death, and he later committed suicide. He actually had an injury prior to his suicide that caused him to lose all his long-term memory. Nicola Chopp became fearful, and she left the country. She lives in the United States now. I believe she lives in South Carolina. But there's a series of these incidents in which people close to Diana, close to the royals, meet with terrible accidents that are actually very, very unusual. Sarah Ferguson's mother, Susan Barrantes, was divorced from Sarah Ferguson's father. Sarah Ferguson is the Duchess of York. She's married to Prince Charles's brother, Prince Andrew. And she was a good friend of Diana's at the time. And when she went through her marital woes with Prince Andrew, her mother, Susan Barrantes, decided that she might write a book. And she'd already written a book about polo. Susan Barrantes had been a fixture on the British and international polo scenes, and she's said to have been a lover of the Queen's husband, Prince Philip. She was quite beautiful when she was younger. And Susan Barrantes met with a terrible car crash, supposedly a fluke. She was driving in a Land Rover with her nephew one evening, going into town to do some grocery shopping, and supposedly was hit by a van owned by a neighbor. The neighbor claims he was blinded by a flash of light. The impact of the crash was so enormous that Susan Barrantes was decapitated. These These are very unusual incidents, and they happen to people who are around the royal family. And Princess Diana did notice it, and she spoke to people that she did fear for her life. And, she, you know, she had good reason to. But
well, let me ask you this then, Sarah. You've got two children that you love, right? There's
right.
no doubt that she loved Harry and Will.
Right.
There's no doubt that she loved the charity work that she was able to do, the good things she was able to accomplish, all the positive reinforcement and things that she had. Why would she go out of her way to then make such cutting comments if she was so fearful for her own life? Why would she put herself in the crosshairs to do these things?
Some people theorize that this is part of her family heritage as a Spencer. This branch of the Spencer family, they're known for being outspoken. They're known for being critical, not just of royalty, but of many things. And also, she did not, I don't think she really had the upbringing that is typical of royals. She was an aristocrat. Her parents were close to royalty, but they were divorced. She was not brought into the fold the way other people would. You know, Prince Charles, when he was, I think, 19 or 20, he gave an interview, and he said something very interesting when they asked him if he would marry a commoner. And he, you know, he didn't refuse it. His own grandmother was technically a commoner. But he said the advantage to marrying someone royal from a royal house is that they do know what happens. Those people live by a different set of rules, social mores. They have a code. And I don't think that Princess Diana was ever brought up to speed on the code. Now, this isn't true of her sisters, who were older than her and frankly had a little more education. You know, these are women who, you know, they're not brainiacs or anything, but they were very mindful of their social position. And Princess Diana, maybe because of her beauty and her charm and, you know, this incredible public appeal she had, she was a bit more reckless. She was a reckless individual. At the same time, very fearful. I mean, I think that in the end, Mohammed Al-Fayed and his son Dodi represented a big escape for her. And, you know, she had achieved these enormous things. I mean, this is a girl who frankly didn't finish what Americans would consider high school. She went to a finishing school and, you know, then became a glorified babysitter and married the heir to one of the oldest royal houses in the world. So she seemed to have had it made. But I think there was always that awareness that she wasn't quite up to, she was there to be decorative. She was there to have children. But, you know, her public appeal was enormous. Like I said, people connected with her. They sensed this goddess quality that was very genuine. And it had nothing to do with college degrees or accomplishments. It's instinctive. It's intuitive. That's what she had. You know, the Virgin Mary is not known for having a PhD or anything. She's the mother of God. I mean, she symbolizes the divine feminine, and people relate to that. Princess Diana did the same, but she did step up, and she took on a landmine crusade. She went to Bosnia. She went to Angola. She went to very dangerous places. She walked through a minefield. All of a sudden, she was doing something that the royals not only, they can't engage in politics. That is a deal that was made with Parliament. And in order, the Queen remains head of state, the monarch remains head of state, but they do not engage in political discourse. That is left to the people's elected officials in Parliament and maybe the House of Lords if they want to pipe up about something. But,
right,
Diana,
but you've got her in these places, then wouldn't it have been easier to kill her when she's in these war-torn areas doing her mine crusade. Wouldn't it have been easier to kill her and say that it was an outside rogue force there that did it, which would deflect all the attention as it possibly being the royal connection? Not killing her lover, not killing, you know, them in a public spectacle where they could be seen as they were.
Well, I don't know that the spectacle was all that public. I mean, it was done in a tunnel so that people could not see it. It wasn't done on the Champs-Élysées. I mean, ordinarily, you would leave the Ritz Hotel, you would come around the Place de Concorde, and you would make a right on the Champs-Élysées. Dodi Al-Fayed's apartment was at the other end by the Arc de Triomphe. It's a long stretch, and you know, most assuredly nothing would happen to them. It's broken by traffic lights. There's a huge amount of foot traffic all up and down the Champs-Élysées. So there would have been lots of people looking. And there would have been cameras. There would have been speed cameras everywhere. But in the Alma Tunnel, where there are 14 traffic cameras, none of them worked. 14 closed-circuit TV cameras. None of them worked on the night that Princess Diana had her accident. And, you know, there is a certain amount of risk. Like you say, she could have been in Bosnia and maybe a sniper would have killed her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's certainly a possibility. She could have been in Angola and something dreadful might have happened. But those visits were very carefully scripted. There was no script for her, you know, vacations with Dodi. They were not following a script. And they had bodyguards who, interestingly, you know, are usually former British military commandos, which raises some issues. These are people with close ties to the British Secret Services anyway. And, of course, you have, you know, these shadowy figures like Henri Paul, who ended up driving the car. He was head of Ritz Security, died with a huge amount of cash on him, thousands of dollars, and he also had hundreds of thousands of dollars stashed away in more than five bank accounts, which, given his salary, I mean, the amount of money is impossible to accumulate. The math has been done on that. So the implication is that maybe Henri Paul was spying on the side independently, you know, not a government agent per se, but a contract worker, someone who would inform various intelligence services about, you know, who was staying at the Ritz and what they were doing and who they were meeting. And for that,
we have to take a break, Sarah. Royal Vengeance, the assassination of Princess Diana and the ancient royal cult of human sacrifice. And what are your thoughts? We'll open up phone lines at the bottom of the next hour. You're welcome to call in and speak with our guest. Questions, concerns, thoughts. We'll do that when we return. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, and this is Coast to Coast AM.